content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is The Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the February 27th, 2026 issue of The Week. Our cover drawing this week, we have a young professional sitting at a desk. He's wearing a suit. He's got his laptop open in front of him, a cup of coffee, his phone, a couple of papers to the side. But he's kind of looking over his shoulder, and behind him we see a huge wave. Embedded in the wave are all kind of digital things, ones and zeros, circuit boards, monitors. And the headline is, the AI tsunami. Will it wipe out most white-collar jobs? And we catch that as a Talking Points article. We'll start with one of the main stories. DOJ tries to close the book on Epstein files. What happened? Democratic and Republican lawmakers this week rejected the Justice Department's contention that it had released all its files on Jeffrey Epstein as required by law, while new revelations from the document spurred more resignations from high-profile people connected to the convicted sex offender. Following a combative hearing on Capitol Hill last week, Attorney General Pam Bondi sent a letter to Congress saying her department had complied with the Epstein Files Transparency Act and would not make any more material public. She attached a list of 300 famous names mentioned in the files, ranging from the Obamas and Clintons to Elvis Presley, with no context to indicate why the names were there. Representative Ro Khanna, Democrat from California, who co-wrote the Transparency Act with Representative Thomas Massie, Republican from Kentucky, accused the DOJ of purposefully muddying the waters on who was a predator and who was mentioned in an email by listing names like Janis Joplin, who died when Epstein was 17. Billionaire Thomas Pritzker stepped down as executive chairman of Hyatt Hotels this week after files showed he stayed in regular contact with Epstein after the financier's 2008 conviction for soliciting a minor for sex. The documents also brought former Obama administration lawyer Kathy Ruemmler's longstanding friendship with Epstein to light. She announced she would leave her post as Goldman Sachs general counsel. Yet President Trump, who is referenced hundreds of thousands of times in the files, stuck by his Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick, even though Lutnick was shown to have visited Epstein's private Caribbean island in 2012 after earlier claiming to have cut ties. In a show of support, Trump brought Lutnick aboard Air Force One with him to visit troops at North Carolina's Fort Bragg. What the columnist said. Bondi's performance during last week's hearing was unprofessional and disrespectful, said the New York Times in an editorial. The attorney general sneered when offered the opportunity to apologize to some of the women Epstein abused, women sitting directly behind her. And she lobbed schoolyard taunts at lawmakers, calling one a washed-up loser. To avoid answering question, she boasted that the Dow had topped 50,000. Bondi's DOJ has only exposed the victims to further humiliation while shielding the powerful behind a wall of redactions. Those redactions didn't protect everyone, said Aidan McLaughlin in Vanity Fair. Steve Bannon, who developed a disturbingly close friendship with Epstein before the latter's death by suicide in prison in 2019, is all over the files. While the documents haven't implicated him in criminal wrongdoing, they show that Bannon enlisted Epstein's help in his international crusade against globalism. In one exchange, Bannon vowed to take down Pope Francis, and that he advised Epstein on how to rehabilitate his reputation. First, we need to push back on the lies, Bannon wrote in one message. Then crush the pedo-trafficking narrative, then rebuild your image as a philanthropist. Bannon deserves opprobrium, said Noah Rothman in National Review. But the Epstein saga is fast becoming a classic moral panic. Massey and Khanna have prioritized emotional reasoning over logic in their haste to finger perpetrators, showing no regard for presumption of innocence. To take just one example, said Joe Byrne in the New York Post, Khanna dramatically read off six names he claimed belonged to wealthy, powerful men that the DOJ hid. In fact, four of them were just regular dudes who have absolutely nothing to do with the dead pedophile financier. Still, enough slime has been exposed that even the MAGA faithful want answers, said Christian Paz in Vox. Joe Rogan, the massively popular podcaster who helped deliver Trump young male voters, recently called the DOJ's obfuscations the gaslightiest gaslighting shit I've ever heard in my life. He's not alone. Pollsters say young male voters strongly disapprove of the president's opposition to the full release of the Epstein files. What else would you expect from this White House? Asked Aaron Rugenberg in the New Republic. Under Trump, the GOP has focused on helping the wealthy and well-connected, like Epstein, his cronies, and Trump himself, evade justice for their crimes. Republican lawmakers have been working to shield pesticide makers from liability when their products cause cancer, and the Trump administration has filed multiple legally unhinged lawsuits to try to stop states from making fossil fuel companies pay for pollution. Trump's GOP now runs on a single issue, elite impunity. As Massey put it this week, Trump is still in with the Epstein class. This is the Epstein administration. Controversy of the week. Minneapolis. What did ICE accomplish? The people of Minneapolis just handed President Trump the biggest political humiliation of his second term, said Erica D. Smith in Bloomberg. Border Czar Tom Homan last week announced the end of Operation Metro Surge and a significant drawdown of the massed ICE and Border Patrol agents whose thuggish, trigger-happy tactics traumatized the city and left two U.S. citizens dead. Homan did his best to save face, citing 4,000 undocumented migrants detained and touting a new agreement with local jails to assist in deportations. But city officials deny any deal, and it took 3,000 federal agents 2 months to arrest those 4,000 immigrants at an estimated cost of about $50,000 a detainee. Metro Surge was a failure by every metric, said Zeeshan Aleem in MS.Now. On its first test drive, Trump's fledgling secret police force was defeated by citizens armed with smartphones and whistles. And the brutal scenes captured by bystanders of the killings of protesters Renee Good and Alex Pretty, of people being dragged from their homes and cars, of five-year-olds being detained, generated some brutal poll numbers. Trump's approval rating has sunk to about 40%. A plurality of voters say he's doing a worse job than President Joe Biden. And his approval on immigration is 12 percentage points underwater. For a president once thought to be unbeatable on this issue, this could be a turning point. The optics of Metro Surge were a predictable disaster, said National Review in an editorial. The theory was that muscular show of force in Minneapolis would persuade illegal immigrants nationwide to self-deport. But a broader audience of Americans was also watching, and they sided with civilians over the agents in camouflage. The operation needed more focus and discipline, and the no-nonsense Homan, who recently took over in Minnesota from buffoonish Border Patrol Commander Greg Bovino, could have supplied it. But to throw in the towel like this, handing a win to leftist agitators, sets an awful precedent that will hamstring future efforts to enforce immigration laws. ICE did accomplish its mission in Minneapolis, said Larry Lee in Fort Wayne, Indiana, Journal-Gazette. As with Trump's deployment of the National Guard to Los Angeles and Chicago, the real purpose of Metro Surge was to normalize the presence of troops in U.S. cities and to scare away non-white citizens who might otherwise head to the polls in the midterms. Trump ally Steve Bannon has said openly that the plan is to have ICE surround the polls in November, said Paul Blumenthal in HuffPost. That's probably bluster, but ICE has already spread enough fear and chaos to terrorize many members of minority communities into staying home on election day. If Metro Surge was a ploy to scare citizens out of voting, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch, it won't work. Every viral video of agents tear-gassing children and demanding Americans show their papers was a de facto campaign commercial for Democrats. Come November, minority voters are more likely to show up in numbers to signal their defiance than to stay home in fear. We still have 3 years left in Trump's second term, and his descent into madness will continue, said Peter Wenner in The Atlantic. But thanks to the brave patriots in Minneapolis, who refuse to take the bait of constant provocations, we have the beginnings of a roadmap to help us withstand the Trump assault on our communities, our democracy, and the essential goodness of America. Good week, bad week. It was a good week for going to the videotape. After Sweden's Olympic curling team claimed Canada's Mark Kennedy was caught on camera releasing and then touching a stone in violation of the rules. Officials said video replay cannot be used in the sport in which athletes police their own throws. In response to the cheating allegation, Kennedy told the Swedes, F off. It's a good week for telling your story after Mike Lindell, the election-denying pillow tycoon and Trump ally running to be Minnesota governor, spent $187,000 of his campaign funds buying copies of his own autobiography. Lindell says that distributing the books to voters will give him an edge over rival candidates who are just giving out a little flyer. It's a good week for subtweeting. After former President George W. Bush published a President's Day essay praising the many virtues of George Washington, including his self-control, modesty, and lack of selfish ambition. But it was a bad week for sliding sports after athlete villages for the Milan Cortina Winter Olympics ran out of free condoms in 3 days, forcing organizers to promise a restock. I think 10,000 have been used, said Olympic spokesman Mark Adams. 2,800 athletes, you can go figure, as they say. It's a bad week for perfection. After Italy's state broadcaster used a digitally altered version of Leonardo da Vinci's iconic Vitruvian Man drawing, a study of ideal human proportions, in the opening credits of its Winter Olympics coverage. Opposition lawmakers demanded Culture Minister Alessandro Guilli shed full light on the decision to modify an absolute masterpiece by removing its genitals. Finally, it was a bad week for germ theory. After Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. told podcaster Theo Vaughn that he was never really worried about contracting COVID during the pandemic. I'm not scared of a germ, Kennedy explained. I used to snort cocaine off of toilet seats. Here's a short piece from the U.S. at a glance. Just a note from Chicago, Jesse Jackson dies. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, pillar of the civil rights movement and two-time presidential candidate known for his impassioned, booming sermons and populist message, died peacefully at his home in Chicago this week. He was 84. Jackson worked alongside Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., joining the marches and sit-ins, including the 1965 Selma to Montgomery March, before founding the social justice organization Rainbow Push Coalition in 1971. In 1984 and 1988, he unsuccessfully sought the Democratic presidential nomination with a progressive platform and a stirring slogan, Keep Hope Alive, that won him 18 and 29% of delegates, respectively. His moral authority and global fame made him a prominent hostage negotiator, winning the release of Americans in Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. Since 2015, Jackson has been suffering from a rare neurological disorder that made it difficult for him to move and speak. A full obituary will appear in the week's next issue. Time for the briefing. Title this week is Trump's Detention Empire. As reports mount of abuse and neglect at ICE detention centers, vast new facilities are in the works. How many people are being held? As of mid-January, Immigration and Customs Enforcement had some 73,000 people in detention, its highest number ever, and 81% increase from the same point in 2025. The numbers are spiking not only because of the Trump administration's enforcement blitz, but also because of a radical shift away from decades-old policies. People charged with civil immigration violations, such as entering the U.S. unlawfully or overstaying a visa, now face mandatory detention while their cases wind through overtaxed courts. Previously, migrants in this situation would typically be released on bond, especially asylum seekers and those who lived in the U.S. for years and don't have criminal records. The result of that change is a crush of detainees being kept in more than 200 locations, including county jails, ICE field offices, military sites, and tent facilities such as Florida's notorious alligator Alcatraz. The U.S. already had the largest detention and removal infrastructure of any country in the world, said Doris Meisner of the Migration Policy Institute, and now it's being put on steroids. What are the conditions like? Detainees describe a litany of horrors from extreme overcrowding to physical abuse. It's like a concentration camp, said Seamus Culleton, an Irish national who spent 5 months at Camp East, Montana, an ICE facility in El Paso, Texas. A Boston plastering contractor who is married to a U.S. citizen and has applied for a green card, Culleton said he is being held in a cold, damp room with some 70 other men, is constantly hungry because the meals are child size, and has been allowed outside fewer than a dozen times. It's not just detainees blowing the whistle. A former worker at a Baltimore ICE facility said officers there treated migrants like animals, with people left lying in feces and detainees in overstuffed cells lying on the floor head to toe. That scene reminded the worker of images of how they brought the slaves from Africa. Nonprofit groups that focus on human rights abuses have also produced damning reports on U.S. facilities. What do they say? An Amnesty International report on alligator Alcatraz detailed food contaminated with maggots, sewage seeping into sleeping areas, and insect infestations. At other facilities in Florida, Human Rights Watch documented people sleeping on cold concrete floors, inmates in psychological distress subjected to solitary confinement, and men being forced to eat with their hands shackled behind their backs. The guards treat you like garbage, said a Colombian detainee. You feel like your life is over. Numerous reports and lawsuits include allegations of medical neglect, among them the dismissal of serious complaints such as chest pains. At least 32 people died in ICE custody last year, up from 11 in 2024. Six more died in January, including Geraldo Lunas Campos, a 55-year-old Cuban immigrant at Camp East Montana, who stopped breathing after a struggle with detention guards. The Trump administration said the guards tried to save Lunas Campos from a suicide attempt. An autopsy report gave the cause of death as homicide by asphyxiation. Despite such reports, the administration is planning to significantly expand its detention capacity. How many facilities are in the works? Flush with $45 billion allocated for new detention centers in last year's spending bill, ICE has in recent weeks bought seven massive warehouses in five states. They include a $70 million warehouse the size of seven football fields outside Phoenix and a 119 million, 1.3 million square foot former Big Lots distribution center near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. That's expected to house up to 7,500 people. That's nearly double the number of inmates currently held at the largest federal prison. In all, ICE is proposing 23 new sites that together would hold 80,000 people. But fierce local opposition is hampering those plans. Have any new facilities been blocked? Protest and political pressure have led some site sellers to back out of deals. We understand that the conversation around immigration policy is particularly heated, the owners of an Ashland, Virginia warehouse said after canceling a federal sale. Firm in Oklahoma City reversed course following a meeting with Republican Mayor David Holt, while the owners of a Salt Lake City warehouse rumored to be in ICE's sights said they had no plans to sell after protests outside their offices. Many opponents of the facilities are motivated by humanitarian concerns. Other sites strain on local resources and loss of tax revenue. A mega detention center planned for Byhalia, Mississippi, would foreclose on economic opportunities better suited for this site. Senator Roger Wicker, Republican from Mississippi, wrote to Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. An ICE official said such facilities make communities safer for business owners and customers. The agency also denies allegations of neglect and abuse at its centers, but critics and detainees say the brutality is real and a deliberate policy choice. What do they say is the goal? To deter anyone else who might come to the U.S. unlawfully and to make those already here self-deport, even if their immigration cases are still working through the system. They do it so you give up, said Julio Cesar Santos Avalos, who was held in an ICE facility in California City, California. Detainees there have complained of being denied insulin and other medications. In a lawsuit, immigrants called the center a torture chamber. It was too much for Avalos, 47, who suffers from chronic pain due to a foot deformity. Denied pain meds and forced to sleep on a top bunk, he left his two children in California and self-deported to El Salvador, which he last saw at age 7. Some of his former fellow detainees are wrestling with similar choices. This place, said Cambodian national Sokien Khao, is built to break us. And we'll read a few of the best columns. First one comes from the U.S. Trump's pagan worldview. The Trump administration has rejected the values of Christianity and adopted paganism, said Leighton Woodhouse. In the ancient world, the Greeks and Romans believed that the strong do what they can and the weak suffer what they must, as Thucydides put it. Donald Trump's deputy chief of staff, Stephen Miller, recently echoed this pagan worldview. You can talk about international niceties, he said, But we live in a real world that is governed by strength, that is governed by force, that is governed by power. The naive niceties Miller dismissed are the moral center of the Judeo-Christian tradition. Christianity was revolutionary because it taught that all humans are God's creation. To oppress any person, even a slave, is an offense before him. Indeed, the weak are closer to God than the rich and the powerful. Trump and his allies emphatically reject Christ's teachings. By extorting Venezuela for its oil, by threatening to annex Greenland and attack even our allies, they are acting like the ancient Greeks or barbarian tribes, without shame or apology. ISIS's violent immigration crusade also repudiates Christian values. For this, a moral strongman government, Thucydides' famous aphorism describes the world they wish to make. This column comes from Canada. Don't we want to be a refuge? U.S. citizens who think they can flee to Canada to escape Donald Trump won't find it easy, said Greg Willoughby. Many of us Canadians are sympathetic, of course. As a refugee lawyer, I'm appalled at the rise in hate speech in the U.S. and the behavior of the ICE stormtroopers who brutalize people regardless of their citizenship. In the past year, a third of my caseload has become U.S. residents who say they no longer recognize their increasingly authoritarian country. But Canada has changed, too. Its reputation as a safe haven has unraveled over the last decade. Former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, after taking in some 73,000 Syrians from 2015 to 2020, cut refugee admissions sharply, and Mark Carney is cutting them further. American cases are often tossed out on technical grounds because the U.S. is still categorized as a safe country. And some of my colleagues don't even want to help Americans, saying these people voted for Trump twice and are only getting what they deserve. For those escaping Trump's America are likely not Trump voters, but minorities that are now finding themselves persecuted. LGBTQ people, Jews, Muslims, dissidents. Ottawa has the power to let them in if it chooses. It's time to decide what kind of country we want to be. This column comes from Ukraine. In defense of our loyal Olympian. It's hard for Ukrainian athletes to do anything patriotic that criticizes Russia, said Serhiy Marchenko. Their athletic regimen is still a legacy of Soviet times, and they train under and alongside Russians. Freestyle skier Oleksandr Abramenko, the only Ukrainian athlete to medal at the last two Olympics, wouldn't even unequivocally call Russia an aggressor when asked by the press. That's why this year in Milan, it was so refreshing to see Vladislav Hereshevich, Ukraine's sole skeleton racer, take a strong stance against the war by demanding to wear a helmet featuring photos of 24 of the Ukrainian athletes who were killed by invading Russian forces. These were just a sampling. Russian attacks have killed over 650 Ukrainian athletes and coaches and destroyed 800 sports facilities. The International Olympic Committee bars political protest, so it tried to find a compromise, saying that he could wear the helmet for interviews but not competition. When Hereshevich refused, he was disqualified. His teammates have showered him with messages of support, yet what he really needs is for them to follow him in honoring their slaughtered comrades. Disqualifying all 46 Ukrainians would be a scandal that IOC officials would definitely not want, and the committee would have to bend. Banding together as a team is how real athletes do it. One for all, and all for one. The last word, our feature article, cutting the lifelines. President Trump vowed to defeat childhood cancer, said Ed Pilkington in The Guardian. But his administration is dismantling research into cures and sending families scrambling for treatment. For 7 years, Jen Janosko cared for children with cancer on the ninth floor of New York's Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital. It's the happiest, sad place she knows. The walls of the pediatric inpatient unit are covered in colorful children's artwork. Older people do laps pushing their IV poles while the younger ones trundle around on wagons. There's a playroom in which they hold themed events, bingo nights, candy cart nights, to inject some fun into a space otherwise sated with illness and death. 1 year, Janosko, who worked as a nurse, dressed up as a blow-up cow to make the kids laugh. The floor has its own soundtrack. There's the ubiquitous beeping of machines, low battery alert, air in line, infusion complete. On a good day, it echoes with laughter and the chirping of little voices. Many other days, there is crying and sometimes screaming as the kids are held down to change their dressings or Metaport needles. The worst days are the silent days when a patient is approaching death. It's when you brace yourself for what follows, the wailing of parents who have lost their child. Janosko knew all these sights and sounds so intimately that last August, when she returned to the ward holding 4-year-old Izzy's hand, it felt like a homecoming. Except this time, her own daughter was the patient. Izzy had been diagnosed with the cancer every nurse on the ninth floor fears most, diffuse intrinsic pontine glioma, or DIPG. There is no cure, and the cancer is almost universally fatal. The tumor arises in the brainstem, which controls critical functions such as breathing and heart rate. Surgery is usually impossible given the location, and the disease progresses with brutal speed, with a median survival of 11 months. Most parents have no idea what a DIPG diagnosis means. Janosko knew exactly. She was all too aware of the standard treatment of radiation and chemotherapy ultimately does not work. The only hope for Janosko was to find a clinical trial that would offer Izzy the prospect of a few more months or years of life, or if she dared to dream, even a glimpse of that elusive cure. For the past 4 months, Janosko has chased that vanishingly small hope relentlessly. She has tracked down the 10 medical centers in the U.S. offering the most promising clinical trials, calling them again and again until she had to restrain herself, worried about causing irritation. Most trials had a long waiting list, while others were not a good fit for Izzy's condition. One, however, could have been a match, a clinical trial run by Izzy's own neurosurgeon at Memorial. But a new hurdle emerged. The trial, which was ready to launch in cancer centers across the country, was abruptly called off. Politics had intervened, Janosko was told. The Trump administration's dismantling of federal agencies has hit cancer research hard. It has led to budgets being slashed, grants canceled or delayed, while clinical trials, often the final hope for children with terminal illness, have been suspended or closed. Laboratories have imposed a hiring freeze on researchers and postponed orders for new equipment, and world-class scientists are seeking jobs in the private sector or abroad. Izzy and children like her are suffering the consequences. For the families involved, this means so much more than the cold budgetary figures cited in congressional debates or across news headlines. I know what DIPG does to kids, Janosko said. Eventually, they can't move, they can't talk or smile or eat, they can't see or hear, but their minds are fully intact. That's the urgency. She put the reality facing her daughter starkly. If I don't find a clinical trial for my child, she'll be dead in a year. The paradox is hard to miss. Trump's bid to make America great again is undermining an area in which America is already great, at the global forefront of the search for a cure for this disease. Over the past 15 years, U.S. medical centers have pioneered breakthroughs in understanding the genetic makeup of child brain tumors. American scientists working with colleagues around the world have expanded knowledge of the mutations that cause the tumors to grow. Those advances have spawned new treatments targeting the cancer's weak spots at a cellular level. The resulting clinical trials, many of them customized to target the vulnerabilities of each child's own tumor, do not yet amount to a cure, but they do point toward the path forward. A very small but potentially significant number of children with DIPG are still alive several years into treatment. But science, even at its most altruistic, still needs funding. These cancers are so rare, about 5,000 children are diagnosed with brain tumors in the U.S. each year, including about 300 with the deadly DIPG, that there is little profit incentive to lure Big Pharma. Federal money is therefore vital, but government support has been limited even during normal administrations. Pediatric cancers are now the leading cause of death by disease for children in the U.S., with brain tumors being the most common. Yet child cancers get only 4% to 8% of the federal pie set aside for medical research into cancer generally. Donald Trump has promised to defeat childhood cancer once and for all. On the front lines of the disease, scientists and families say the opposite is unfolding. Within days of Trump's inauguration, the White House imposed a funding freeze on all federal agencies, including the National Institutes of Health. Hundreds of grants were canceled, disrupting clinical trials for brain cancer, heart disease, and other conditions that had been treating 74,000 patients. The administration then shifted the goalpost on how federal research grants were distributed. Instead of the top 9% of peer-reviewed applications being approved, from now on, only 4% would go ahead. And in August, the Trump administration said it would withdraw support from the Pediatric Brain Tumor Consortium, PBTC, North America's oldest and most productive pediatric brain cancer research network. Almost overnight, the decision brought many of the continent's most promising clinical trials to a halt. Children who were already participating in those trials would continue to receive care, but families like Izzy's had a bitter pill to swallow. The experiments on which they had pinned their last hope would henceforth be closed to new patients. Dr. Mark Saladin, Izzy's neurosurgeon at Memorial, designed a clinical trial during which tiny catheters are inserted directly into the brain tissue to channel high concentrations of therapeutic agents slowly into the tumor. Early tests had been promising. Several children on the trial lived longer than 3 years, and three patients are long-term survivors. One of them is still alive 12 years on. When Izzy was first diagnosed, it appeared that she would be a candidate for this novel drug delivery technique. So Saladin was only weeks away from launching an expanded trial across 12 medical centers nationwide when the Trump administration closed the consortium, forcing Saladin to call off the launch. The other groundbreaking new treatment Genosco hoped to secure is called CAR T-cell therapy, which take T-cells from a patient's blood and trains them to recognize and attack cancer cells. At the time of my visit, however, every door remained closed to her. A clinical trial at Texas Children's Cancer Center had been suspended as a result of the consortium's closure. She tried Stanford Medicine in California and was told that the trial was taking only one new patient each month. And at Seattle Children's Hospital, she learned that more than 50 kids were already on the waiting list. Dr. Hugene Wang, a pediatric neuro-oncologist at George Washington University Cancer Center in Washington, D.C., who led the PBTC's working group on immunotherapy, and Dr. Elias Sayor, a pediatric oncologist at the University of Florida Health, were working on devising a new treatment for DIPG involving an mRNA vaccine using similar technology to the COVID vaccine. A rigorous peer-reviewed process placed their proposal within the top 7% of grant applications, well within the 9% that had been the federal government's official cutoff. When the qualifying band was reduced to 4%, their hopes and ambitions were set back. I asked the White House and the Health and Human Services Department for comment about the apparent stark contrasts between Trump's pledge to defeat childhood cancer and the reality on the ground. HHS responded with a statement. NIH continues to invest significantly in bold and innovative cancer research, it said. Ending the scourge of cancer is one of our highest priorities, as reflected in the National Cancer Institute's budget of more than $7 billion, the largest of any NIH institute or center. NCI Director Dr. Anthony Letai also commented that the NCI, which leads most U.S. cancer research, spent more last year in extramural grants than in any previous year, and that pediatric brain cancer research remains a high priority. He added that the decision to pivot away from the consortium had been made for good logistical reasons. PBTC trials would be enrolled in a new system as soon as feasible. For parents of children who potentially have just a few months to live, as soon as feasible is a hard sell. She was the most courageous person I've ever met, Mike Henry told me. Mike and his wife, Kate, were both 36 when their daughter Blair was diagnosed with a rare and fast-growing brain tumor called ETMR. She was just shy of 3. She died 8 months later. A month into chemotherapy, the Henrys were presented with a choice so brutal that their oncologist, a veteran with decades of experience, cried as she explained it. She told us it was a fork in the road, Mike said. Either we could handcuff Blair to this bed, pin her down to give her shots that made her sick until she passed away in the hospital, or we could spend the next few months with her at home doing things she loved. We knew that if we decided to take her home, she would die. 10 days before her third birthday, they chose home. Blair's illness and death have transformed the Henrys' lives beyond recognition. Almost 6 years later, they still devote themselves to finding a cure for pediatric brain tumors. It's Blair's legacy. Kate is now an active member of a bereavement group working in the Philadelphia area. Mike is director of advocacy for the Pediatric Brain Tumor Foundation, a nonprofit that offers family support, raises research funding, and pushes for government action. Mike Henry used to work in public policy. That old life now gives him pause. In 2013-14, he was employed by Heritage Action, the political arm of the conservative Heritage Foundation that would, a decade later, go on to draft Project 2025, guidelines for the new administration that in effect called for the dismantling of NIH. Henry looks back on how he used to lobby for fiscal responsibility and smaller government and ponders, since Blair became sick, the way he perceives the role of government and the importance of caring for one another has changed drastically. He knows now that what he did not know then, that in an instant, any one of us can be toppled from our lives and plummet to the depths. We had a great family, stable jobs, 2 wonderful children. We lost all of our savings in the first 2 weeks after the diagnosis. We were thrust on Medicaid, unemployment, and then we lost Blair. The foundation Henry works for is scrambling, alongside many charitable groups formed by bereaved parents, to raise money to fill the void left by Trump's cuts. They can never compete with the vastness of federal funding, but but their voices and passion serve an important purpose. They send a message to politicians on Capitol Hill. The same goes for Huang. He is determined to present an optimistic face to worried families and to find a new way forward for his mRNA vaccine. If I thought that something was insurmountable, I would just go home, and that would be a disservice to these families and to these children. And there's another reason not to give up. Every so often, a ray of light pierces through. A couple of weeks after my visit, Genosko contacted me. She had news. Stanford had offered Izzy a place in its CAR T-cell clinical trial. "I'm petrified and I'm ecstatic," she said. Being the pediatric cancer center nurse that she is, Genosko knows exactly what this entails. There will be anxiety aplenty and possible side effects. Izzy will shed her cornucopia of golden curls. The treatment might not work, but for some, it does. One Stanford patient, Drew, responded completely. His tumor disappeared from brain scans, and he is still clear 5 years on. They signed the consent forms in Stanford in early January. The next day, Izzy's treatment began. This was adapted from a story originally published in The Guardian. Here's one of the obituaries. The shapeshifter who could be savage or sweet. Robert Duvall, 1931 to 2026. Robert Duvall disappeared into his characters. Over a six-decade career, he approached highly diverse roles like an ethnologist on a field trip into the soul, as one critic put it. Among his memorable leading performances were roles as an explosive Marine pilot who tyrannizes his family in The Great Santini, 1979, and as a fading alcoholic country singer in Tender Mercies, 1983, which won him a Best Actor Oscar. He also starred as an illiterate, deeply kind farmer in the Faulkner adaptation Tomorrow, 1972, and as a fallen Pentecostal preacher in The Apostle, 1997, which he wrote and directed. But many of Duvall's best performances came in supporting roles, as a ruthless TV executive in Network, 1976, the stoic mob lawyer in The Godfather, 1972, and the maniacal lieutenant colonel in Apocalypse Now, 1979, who loves the smell of napalm in the morning. Secondary roles suited Duvall just fine, he said, and were often more interesting. "Being a leading man is an agent's dream," he said, "not an actor's." Born in San Diego, Duvall grew up in a series of Navy towns where his rear admiral father was stationed, said the Associated Press. An aimless youth, he attended Principia College in Illinois, but nearly flunked out. His concerned parents steered him toward theater, and he flourished in drama classes. After his Army service, he moved to New York City to study acting, falling in with fellow students Gene Hackman and Dustin Hoffman. Working odd jobs to support himself, he soon began landing stage and TV roles. He got his film break when cast as the misunderstood recluse Boo Radley in To Kill a Mockingbird, 1962, said Rolling Stone, making an indelible impression without speaking a word of dialogue. Having built his reputation as a character actor over the next decade, he became a central figure in the new Hollywood of the 1970s, adding grit and soul to legendary works from directors such as George Lucas, Robert Altman, and Francis Ford Coppola. An exacting performer who researched roles with intense studiousness, Duvall was also a private man who kept Hollywood at arm's length, to the New York Times. He spent years living with his fourth wife on a horse farm in rural Virginia, though he acted into his 90s. Despite that intensity, he was unpretentious about his craft, which, he said, just boil down to talking and listening. In acting, there's no right or wrong, he said, just truthful or untruthful. Here's a health and science short. The game that prevents dementia. A simple computer brain training game could cut the risk of dementia for decades. Researchers looked at data from the federally funded Advanced Cognitive Training for Independent and Vital Elderly trial, which enrolled nearly 3,000 adults aged 65 and over who had no significant cognitive impairment. Participants were assigned to trainings on visual speed, memory, or reasoning about an hour at a time, twice a week for 5 weeks. Half of each group also did follow-up training for 3 years. Those in the speed training cohort who had completed the follow-up sessions were 25% less likely to develop Alzheimer's or other dementias over the next 20 years. The other groups showed no correlation. The speed program, a game called Double Decision, available from the company Brain HQ, trains users to process visual information more quickly by identifying objects and locations that flash briefly on a screen. New York University neurologist Thomas Wisniewski tells NBCNews.com the results are astonishing, saying it's really the first clear documentation in a randomized controlled trial that at least some form of cognitive training can lower the risk of dementia. And we've got that Talking Points article that was referenced on the cover drawing. AI, yes, it's coming for your job. Humans no longer are, or soon will no longer be, the most intelligent beings on the planet, said Noah Smith in the Free Press. Artificial intelligence has advanced so rapidly over the past year that it's surpassing human intelligence in performing nearly every task. That's the thesis of a viral essay published last week by Matt Schumer, CEO of AI company Otherside AI. Schumer said the latest AI versions from Claude and ChatGPT, available only through paid subscriptions, are such a major leap that he can give them a complex assignment like creating an app, and voila. Far faster than any human, the AI will write all the code, create the app, test it, and refine it. Schumer warns that AI may replace half of all white-collar jobs within 5 years. Critics call Schumer an alarmist, but I suspect he understates the pace and magnitude of the changes taking place. Like Native Americans who saw sailing ships disgorging European settlers on their shores, we're coming face to face with forces greater and more powerful than ourselves. We may soon lose control of our destiny forever. AI will certainly be very disruptive to jobs, said James Pithokoukas in Vox, but energy capacity and decisions about AI regulation, development, and adoption will move at ordinary speeds. About 80% of U.S. businesses do not currently use AI, and they won't shift to heavy reliance overnight. Over time, the economy will adapt and shift jobs toward hands-on human work AI can't do well, such as healthcare, education, and creative work. Some urgency may be warranted, but Schumer's AI apocalypse warning of a rapid job wipeout is overly pessimistic. Still, what if the doomers are right? Asked Philip Klein in National Review. If AI advances so quickly that millions of highly educated, well-paid white-collar workers become not only unemployed, but unemployable, it will be more destabilizing to our politics than anything we have previously experienced. In the worst-case scenario, elite anger could fuse with populism and spark revolutionary fervor that sweeps through the nation and topples the republic. Remember, though, we get to decide how technology is used, said Jonathan D. Last in The Bulwark. Before it's too late, we must create rules that govern how industries may use AI, just as we regulate so many other endeavors. We don't have to walk into the dystopian future just because OpenAI builds it. And one or two of the short notes. There are now more farmers age 75 and older in the U.S. than farmers under the age 35, according to the Agriculture Department. Partly because many farmers' children are choosing to work in less volatile and more profitable industries. Last year, 315 farms filed for bankruptcy, a 46% rise over the previous year. After 88 years, Gallup will stop tracking presidential approval ratings, the polling firm announced last week, citing a shift in research goals and priorities. Gallup's presidential approval rating is one of the most respected bellwethers of public opinion on the president's performance. In December, President Trump's approval rating dropped to 36%, one of the lowest Gallup has ever recorded. On the poll watch, 60% of Americans disapprove of President Trump's handling of immigration and border security, up 9 percentage points since April 2025. And we'll finish with a quote from Annie Lamott, quoted in Southern Living. It's good to do uncomfortable things. It's weight training for life. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.